Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Lovely to be with you on this spring weekend, a great weekend to get out there. Good morning, John Lamb.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, gardeners, particularly gardeners that really want to do something about preparing their vegetables, their summer vegetables, for the hot weather ahead.
Well, there's one thing that's on the minds of many gardeners. Is it or is it not the weekend to plant tomatoes? Is it a green for go on tomatoes, John Lamb?
Deb, I think I can say with considerable confidence, let the 2023 tomato planting season begin. There we are.
Soil
temperatures during the week, according to Living Turf, were right on 16 degrees, except at Glenelg, where it's sandy soil down there, and they were actually at 17 degrees. And with 2 weeks of day temperatures probably into the 20s, I think you can plant with a fair amount of confidence. And probably the most important thing is when you plant, protect as well. But more of that shortly, because we'll be talking to one of our top commercial independent vegetable agronomist, Dominic Cavallaro.
We certainly will. And we'll be getting so many texts on tomatoes, and so many varieties are being planted. Nev at Middleton says, I have tomatoes already. First prize on the bush. First prize variety, Grossliss, Kisses flowering, sunny protected spot. Sounds perfect. May in Wyala says, I have a 1 metre self-seeded tomato. It's already set fruit. Lee says, I've planted Oxenheart tomatoes as they're full of flesh and not hollow like many others. And Zeta at West Lakes has got several self-sown tomatoes already flowering, along with many, many, many different varieties that we've received on the text line. So thank you for your information there. But we will also be touching on another issue, which has been in the news a lot this week, John, and that is varroa mite.
Varroa mite. There's a lot of hype out there about varroa mite at the moment, and you think it's going to be the end of the world. It's a very serious disease. But what does varroa mite actually do to a honeybee? And what do they do to our native bees? Our native bee entomologist, Katja Hogendorn, will talk us in the last half of the program, just a quick chat on the effect of varroa mite. When will it arrive here in South Australia, and what's it going to do from a home gardening point of view in terms of the mites are going to affect the honeybees? They're important from a pollination point of view in pollinating our vegetables, our fruit trees and flowers. The effect on South Australian gardens.
So we'll talk about those and as many other issues as we can fit in, but of course your questions also, and the number is 1300 222 891. Happy to take your comments on 0467 922 891, and I have a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away later in the program as well.
Traditionally, tomatoes are planted in South Australia the week after the grand final. Well, that's not a couple of weeks away.
It is.
And I think many people have got their tomatoes in and they'll probably go in this weekend. So great gardening weather, and it's important that we take advantage of this great gardening weather at the moment. And it's an opportunity to talk to Dominic Cavallaro, independent vegetable agronomist, and he works through the Adelaide Plains and, of course, looks after all those commercial tomato growers in the Virginia area. Let's say good morning to you, Dominic.
Hello. Good morning, John.
Good.
Yeah, good morning, John. Good morning, Deb.
Nice to know. Listen, let's start by looking at the surveys that we carry out. And the surveys say that those that have the most disappointing crops probably are over-fertilising their crops, their seedlings in particular, and overwatering. Would you care to comment on that as a starting point?
That's a good comment, John. I think being careful not to over-fertilise the tomatoes early. So you put just enough fertiliser in to get them started. And because if you over-fertilise, what can happen is the plants get into a luxury situation where they don't want to put flowers on, they'll put leaves on, so they just want to grow vegetative. And so a bit lean and mean to start with, just to strengthen the flowers and just let the plant know you want to set fruit and not put on too much leaf.
What actually happens when you put on too much fertiliser on a new seedling that's just come out of a punnet?
What tends to happen is that from the soil, the plants will take up nitrogen more readily, and so you'll tend to get more vegetative growth. And in our industry, we sort of don't want too much vegetative growth. You want it to focus more on flowering and setting up flowers. So the plant gets a little bit lazy and says, "Oh, I can put on heaps of leaves before I need to flower," and that's what tends to happen. And then you'll get a plant that wants to put more leaf on than flowers, or you get flowers setting, very high above the ground.
And I suspect that when it comes out of its punnet to put it in the ground, it hasn't got much of a root system.
No, exactly. And that's where people can get caught, because to start with, you do actually need to water frequently, because you need to allow those roots to go from the small cell to the soil. But once the roots start to move into the soil, that's when you can back off and let the roots sort of explore the soil and get into the nutrients and the water.
Well, let's drill down to both the fertilising and the watering in a little bit more detail. So the nutrition, you're about to plant, you've got your soil, it's nicely cultivated, there's lots of organic matter in the soil, you've got your seedlings and they're ready to go in. Do you put on any fertiliser before you actually put the seedlings into the ground, or do you put that on after? And then what kind of fertiliser do you use when you're putting out the seedlings?
If you've got a really good composted animal manure, or that normally actually has a lot of nutrients in it, so the sort of nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium will be there. You tend to find in the garden, especially if they use them frequently, the phosphorus levels will be high. So the key thing you need is available phosphorus to allow for root growth. The next thing that we don't want to forget about is actually using either gypsum or lime, depending on your soil pH, because we need the available calcium. Phosphorus and calcium help with strong root growth, and calcium helps with the strength of the plants and the strength of the fruit. So it's really good to actually put that into your soil and mix it in prior to planting as well. So
if you buy a bag of fertilizer, or it doesn't have to be in a bag, it might be a liquid one, but it's got the big three, the nitrogen, phosphorus and the potash. Now, you've indicated it's tremendously important that you get in a good amount of phosphorus. What about nitrogen? Can you have too much nitrogen?
Yes, you can early. What we tend to do commercially is you can use NPK to start with. The nitrogen source in those NPK ones are slow releasing, so they're fairly safe. They do depend on temperature, but you don't need a lot. So because we want to establish the seedling and let the flowers, just be a bit lean and set fruit. Once you set fruit, then you can add additional fertilizer, because then the fruit become the sink. And the fertiliser goes to the fruit and the remaining flowers that keep flowering.
All right, so go easy on the nitrogen fertiliser to start with. And the potash, do you need a lot of potash to start with, or do you hang off on the potash and put that on later?
Oh, no, hang off on the potash, because, again, potash is used a lot by the fruit itself. So normally the advice is that there's enough potash in the soil, especially got a good base of compost, and then once you get to about the sort of second or third truss, you start to put the potash on there, because that's when the fruit's drawing on that additional potash.
Okay, so nitrogen, phosphorus and potash, people know how much is in the container by little numbers. So an NPK, what would be the ratio of NP and K that you'd look for your seedlings?
With tomatoes, you want one where you have a higher potassium than nitrogen, because they are a big drawer of potassium. So and the really good thing about it, it's actually easy for a lot of home gardeners, because they'll actually you know, go to your local nursery and they'll say a tomato fertiliser mix, which has got the right ratio of nitrogen.
So if you get a fertiliser for tomatoes and vegetables, that should set you up. Come back to the gypsum. Why is gypsum so important?
A couple of things. One is that it's a available source of calcium, and unfortunately, you know, with things like our water supply is not the best, so soils can build up in sodium. And so what the gypsum does is it unlocks the sodium in the soil and sort of allows that to be leached away and then helps release some of the potassium and magnesium and the calcium, make that available to the plant.
You, as a commercial agronomist, would recommend trace elements, and probably many of them are not available to home gardeners. Apart from the NPK and gypsum, is there anything else that you'd add at planting time?
Yeah, I think one of the key ones that we commercially, we actually do a soil test, so we know what we've got in the soil to start with. Probably the key nutrients and flowering is number one is things like zinc, boron and calcium. So zinc and boron and calcium just help with the flower strength and the strength of the pollen and the strength of the flower. So they are probably the three key important ones too.
All right, you could go and you can buy, say, zinc manganese as a liquid and spray it on. Would that be any value, or that's the wrong?
Yes. No, zinc and manganese would also, from a spraying on point of view, most of our soils are alkaline, and manganese, unfortunately, does get locked up in the soil. So a combination of zinc and manganese to start with would be ideal.
All right, we're talking to Dominic Cavallaro, who's an independent commercial agronomist in the Adelaide Plains area. So I think we've looked at nutrition, and you're saying watering, you've got to make sure that the plants are watered. So many other areas. The use of soil stimulants, the seaweeds, and there are other sort of things, fish and composts and things like that. Are they of value when you're establishing your seedlings, or should you hang off and wait until later?
Oh, no, they are ideal because they're an organic form of nutrient, but also they have natural plant hormones, like things like auxin and cytokinin, which actually help with stronger root growth.
Spacing of the tomato plants. Many people say, right, I've only got a small garden, I want as many plants as I possibly can, and they try and put as many plants close together. What's wrong with close planting, and what is probably a good planting width for, say, a traditional tomato like a Mighty Red and maybe a cherry tomato?
I think you've got to be a bit careful that they don't shade each other. Tomato plant, when you plant a seedling, looks quite small, so you have a tendency to put them closer together, but they can shade. You need to be careful of airflow from a disease point of view. So ideally, you'd be looking at about sort of 40 to 50 centimetres apart.
Okay. When you plant these seedling starts to grow and it's putting on lots of leaves and lots of branches, and the main stem sets out a second stem, and then you've got a third stem, and before long you've got five or six stems all coming from down near the crown of the plant. Can you have, well, I suppose, how do you work it out? How many main framework branches you need on a traditional tomato plant?
If it's indeterminate, which means that you're trying to train it to one stem, what you're trying to do is actually take those other stems out. Otherwise, you'll end up with a plant that's too vegetative and small of fruit. So it's just keep an eye on the tomato plant that's growing, and any of the side shoots that come out, you know, just nip them off while they're small.
So we're talking about the indeterminate. They're the ones that you put on a trellis or a stake.
Correct.
It'll have one stem, and then you'll get your side stems, two or three. How many of those main branches would you have? From a home gardening point of view, I know your commercial growers have one great big long one that goes on and on forever. But
yeah, you can actually have an extra one or two that they, you know, you can have on a side shoot. Commercially, we sometimes actually have up to two stems. So a tomato plant can handle two or three stems. So it depends on your spacing and the type of plant. So, yeah, no problems at all. As long as you stake them and trellis them up so they're off the ground.
All right. And location, getting the sun. Many people are concerned that it's going to be very, very hot during summer, and thinking maybe I'll plant my tomatoes in the shade. Is full shade a possibility? And if not, the difference between morning sun and afternoon, morning shade and afternoon shade?
Yeah, ideally tomatoes like some sun. If they're in a lot of shade, they'll tend to want to grow a lot of leaf and less fruit. So, and the ideal situation is to get morning sun and you know, a little bit of afternoon sun. But as you're going into summer, it's the late sort of mid afternoon where it can get fairly hot. So that's the ideal situation. If it's in full sun, just be prepared to put some shade cloth on the sort of western side, so they don't get too hot and you know, bore flowers or you get burning on your fruit.
Aha! Now you say on the western side. Many people think, oh, when they're putting the shade cloth on, they'll put it all over the plant, on the top and all sides, right down to ground level. Perhaps explain why that's not necessarily so.
What tends to happen, we see that there's commercially tomato plants like to feed in the morning, where there's full sun, so that's when they're most active, and then the afternoon they back off on nutrition and want to take up more water. So the morning sun's and is more important than the afternoon sun. So and the afternoon sun tends to be where the intensity of the heat and temperatures can cause issues. So
I have to do some reorganising in my garden, Dominic. Dominic Cavallaro, a vegetable agronomist, is our special guest. Dominic, can I just throw some sort of speed dating type quick questions at you, please?
No problems at all.
Thank you. I'll grab John from Golden Grove first, who's rung on 1300 222 891. Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning, everybody. We've noticed lately that we've been buying Roma tomatoes and the skins are very tough. Is that a varietal type of issue, or is it something they're doing wrong, which might interest the home gardeners as well?
Some of the tomatoes that are coming are actually from Queensland, so, and they're outdoor tomatoes. So you tend to find outdoor tomatoes have a slightly stronger, a thicker skin than the indoor tomatoes. So that's possibly why they're a bit thicker.
First time I've ever heard that distinction between indoor and outdoor. You mean sort of ones that are grown in a greenhouse versus ones that are grown outside?
Yes, the growers are selecting a variety or a form of a variety that's actually got a thicker skin so that it's got greater durability to outside climate influences.
Excellent question, John. There you go. I'm sure you've educated a lot of us. Dominic Cavallaro, this person says, I believe the Adelaide Hill soil temperatures and therefore planting of tomatoes will be about 2 weeks behind due to a risk of frost. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree. Yeah, so unless you're prepared to sort of put a plastic cover, I'd wait 2 weeks just to play it safe.
Okay. Mary of Cuddly Creek says, when transferring from seedling tray into an individual pot, what type of potting mix should you use, and should it be have fertiliser in it?
Yes, I think it should have fertiliser in it. That sort of makes it easier for as a starter fertiliser. And something that's well drained but not too coarse, so would be the ideal potting mix.
Okay. This texter says, what should you add to horse manure to balance it as a natural organic fertiliser? Would you use that on your tomatoes?
The key thing with horse manure, is to make sure it's composted in the soil in time, so just give it time to break down. Just mix it into the soil so there's no ammonia or things like that. It's a lot safer. Does have a bit more weeds in it, but that doesn't hurt because that can be incorporated into weed seeds and can be incorporated into the soil as they grow.
Okay, Dominic will just take one last question, which is asking about percentage shade cloth, 50, 70, 90.
The ideal one's 50.
Okay.
50%, yes, that's what the commercial growers have been using for quite some time. Before I let you go, Dominic, I suppose the theme is how can you protect your vegetables, not necessarily tomatoes, but your summer vegetables, they're going in now. What are the strategies that gardeners should be carrying out now to minimise the effect of very hot weather, say during December, January, February?
The key thing we touched on is making sure we encourage a really strong root growth, and that happens early, so that good preparation of soil, and also just setting things up so you can easily put up shade cloth with a frame when the time comes with hot weather.
Well, we're both going to thank you at the same time, John.
You go for that, Deb.
Oh, thank you. Well, Dominic, we really appreciate your input all the time on tomatoes and vegetable growing. It's fantastic. So thank you very much for joining us again this morning.
Thank you, Deb. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Dominic Cavallaro, independent horticultural consultant and vegetable specialist in Virginia. And just before we leave tomatoes, Dave at Mount Pleasant says, grew mortgage lifter variety a couple of years ago when Polly House had one that was 440 grams. And was beautiful, thanks to the Diggers Club, Dave. That's amazing. Katie in Sejuna says, mine are powering SA Best and Tommy's. Now, we've got here, check my tomato bed soil temperature at 6 a.m. this morning in Goodwood. Perfect 16 degrees. I'm planting Tigerella, Red and Black, Nonna's Italian Passata and Shimig Craig.
Some interesting names coming through. Deb, what is coming through very clearly now is that people are looking very much at the cherry tomatoes. I think they're going to be well to the fore, and that's very, very sound because cherry tomatoes have got that ability to be able to stand up to that hot, hot weather. And what's coming through is not too many people, and it's only a random sample, are talking about your traditional. I haven't heard one Mighty Red yet. Traditionals, they're out there. And they're very, very reliable. But it's interesting that people are looking for that difference, maybe. Is it a difference in taste that they're looking for, as well as the ability to be able to stand up to the hotter, drier weather that's coming our way?
Well, we'll find out when you do Tomato Season 2024 survey.
Oh, yes, and on that matter, if you're a keen gardener, or even if you're a first-time gardener, you have a little notebook and just write down the varieties you grow, because when we ask you at the end of the season, you've lost the label and you're not too sure what it was. And particularly with there's so many different varieties of cherry tomatoes. And last time you could see that there was Tommy Toe and two or three of the main ones, and then the rest of them were people didn't know which ones, and they just put cherry tomato. And so they consisted about 40% of the tomato varieties. So if you can give us the names of them, that would be important. So write them down now. Write down when you actually planted them, and make some little notes about the nutrition in terms of, are you using your soil stimulants? I'm very interested to see whether people are taking notice of that. There was a big increase in that in the last 12 months. And the one that hasn't taken off, which I think may be needed this year, is your soil wetting agents to be able to get the water distributed more evenly through the water, through the soil. And then, of course, there are the sun-stopping type things, the kale and clays type materials that you spray onto your plants to give them protection from the sun. Mm. And we'll be focusing a lot on that in the
coming
later programs.
Weeks. Yes, indeed. It is 9:30. We're coming back to your talkback gardening calls in just a moment. 1-300-222-891.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's get into your Talk Back Gardening calls now and welcome Lee from Kingston. Kingston Southeast or Kingston on Murray, Lee?
In the Southeast, Deb.
Great. Lovely to have you aboard. Now, you're not having much luck with your strawberries.
No, I bought some new ones last year. They grew like crazy and sent out heaps of runners, but very few strawberries. And yet my older ones were sick and yellow this time of the year, and they still are now, and they yielded really well. But they've become very clumpy. They're sort of, I think they need dividing up. should I dig them up and divide them?
Are you aware of the varieties, the names of the varieties or the types of strawberries you're growing?
No, I can't recall.
Okay.
The new ones, some of them had red flowers on them. just very distinctive dark red flowers.
Strawberries are very, very productive, and they are well worth growing in the garden. But you need to be aware that there are different types of strawberries. There are some strawberries that you plant and it only produces one crop in the year. There are others that will produce two crops, one in spring and one in autumn. And then there's another type which will give you wave after wave after wave. It's like the newer roses. They have some flowers, they'll set fruit, and then they'll have a little regeneration, and you might get three or four waves of fruits during the growing season. And I think that's what happens there. It may be you've planted the ones that didn't fruit, and it's one of those varieties that was out of season in terms of flowering, and so it's just gone into growth mode, and it's produced lots of runners. And I suspect that if you plant those runners out, or if you had planted those out maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, but anyway, the ones that didn't produce fruit last year, I'd be very disappointed if they didn't provide you some nice fruit this spring. And then whether they produce another crop later on will depend on the variety. As for the older varieties, strawberries tend to run out of oomph after 2 or 3 seasons. And so either you start new plants from runners, or you go and buy new virus-free plants and get them established. So if your your strawberries after...
got tomatoes on the brain, John.
It's stuck there, yeah. It's like a tomato. Okay, anyway, you understand where I'm coming from, I hope.
Okay.
Okay, Lee.
So with that gardening diary, Lee, probably good to take a note of the varieties next time, like you do with your tomatoes. And they're both red fruits, John, so I can understand why you're interchanging the names.
And on that particular point, there's not enough information on the labels. When you buy your strawberries, it'll just sort of say lovely strawberries, and keep them well watered and fertilised. It doesn't tell you when it's flowering. And if you go to a garden centre, you can talk to the person behind the counter and say, is this an ever-bearing one or is this a once-in-the-season type of one?
Yes, excellent. Amy's in Greenock. Amy, what fruit trees have you got growing there?
Hi, Deb and John. Well, I gave my 6-year-old plum and apricot trees quite a hard prune at the end of last season. And now I have lots of new growth at the end of the main branches. And I'm not quite sure what to do, whether to thin it out or whether to leave them to the end of the season and prune them then.
Did you say it's a young tree or a well-established tree?
6 years old, so we've had some lovely fruit off of both of them.
All right.
So they were just getting quite big.
Okay, and it's got a framework and it's been cut back, and as a result of cutting back, you've got this little witch's broom, lots of little growth there.
Yeah, yes.
Not good. because it means that you're going to have all your fruit up the out of the witch's broom type growth, and then they'll bend over and you may break the branches.
What do you suggest, John?
It's difficult. At this stage, I would be... maybe, if it was mine... The long branches that have got the whippy little bits at the end, I'd be tying them down horizontally for a growing season. And that would mean that it would slow the growth and the buds lower down towards the crown of the plant. That would encourage the buds towards the lower part of the plant to swell and develop. And so when you prune next winter... and you can prune quite hard, you get lots of new branches coming from lower down, from closer towards the main crown where you get your main branches coming out of the main stem. So I would tie them down, prune in winter quite hard next winter, and reshape the tree. Now, that's a pretty hard thing, not a hard thing to do, but otherwise... I don't know that there's any other easy solution. Maybe, let's say you've got six main branches with whippy things at the end of them, I'd be taking out, cutting three of them back very hard this spring, and you get your new growth, and then the next year you do take out the other three or whatever is 50%.
Okay, thank you, John. Okay.
Thanks, Amy. Good luck with that one. Wayne is on York Peninsula, and you want to transplant a fig tree, Wayne.
Yes, please.
Fire away there, Wayne. I'm a little bit... go ahead.
I've got a fig tree that's been in for 4 or 5 years, and it's about 18 inches high. I get leaves and then drop off, and I've had about one or two figs on it, which are about half an inch long. I want to transplant it into a wine barrel or a bit bigger. Can that be done, or is it too big a root system?
Oh, no. You can almost do what you like with a fig tree. They are very, very, very forgiving. I wouldn't do it now. It would have developed a new root system. It's developed new branches. Can you wait until autumn or winter?
Yeah, I can do that.
Oh, okay. Well, ideally, wait until winter. It'll be dormant, and you can do what you like then, and take it out of the ground, reduce the root system, and reduce the branch system. You can put it back in a container or somewhere else in the garden. The choice is yours.
It's in amongst platypus tree and a gum tree, and I think they must be taking all the stuff from it.
Yes, okay. Well, yeah, the sunlight is what they want, so get them...
Yeah, well, it's in the middle of the sun, yeah.
Righto. Well, to wait till winter, move it, chop it back to whatever size you want, and away you go again.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Wayne. Nice to hear from you. Valerie is in Parkholm. Valerie, you want to talk about citrus. What citrus are you growing there?
Citrus and stone fruit, but they're growing in a I can't think of the word of the lawn. Very tough lawn.
Okay. Kaikuyu?
Kaikuyu, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. And I want to use some Roundup just around the circle of the trees. Does that affect the tree? I understand it doesn't penetrate the soil.
No. So Roundup will kill whatever you spray.
Right.
So if you don't spray the tree, it won't kill it.
Okay.
So, I mean, just on a day like, looking outside at the moment, it's nice and calm, so you don't get any spray drift. Just be aware that when you're spraying, you've got fine little particles and they drift through the air, and if they drift onto the leaves of your citrus, your citrus tree won't particularly be impressed.
So you
can use it around the tree with a fair amount of safety, so long as you're sensible. And, of course, you read the directions before you start spraying.
That's right. Would this be get rid of that drift? Could I use a brush diluted?
Oh, yes, quite okay.
Just to put it on
You wanted
on
to
brush.
Get rid of it. Yeah, that's right. You just get mix it up according to the directions,
right.
And then get a cheap paintbrush, and you could just brush it. You put on gloves on yourself and make sure it'll splash a little bit. So,
that's all right.
But wherever you wipe it over, you can actually buy little wipers, little wick wipers. You don't see many of them now, and they're very, very effective when you've got, say, kikuyu grass growing in the middle of just underneath your perennials, and you don't want to spray your perennials, and just wiping the material, wiping the glyphosate onto the leaves, and so long as you get about 50 or 60% of the leaf coverage, it'll get down into the roots. That is the advantage, of course, of a systemic insecticide or weedicide.
Oh,
it's why they're so valuable, and why I'm trying to defend their role as much as I possibly can, simply because there are so many garden problems that need a solution, and the normal solutions are not sound enough to good, are not effective enough unless you want to keep on repeating and repeating and repeating, and some people don't want to do that.
Mm. I've got quite a few wipers that I use for in the house. If I rinse them, I can use those.
Just don't use them on anything else again.
No.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you could do that, but make sure you've got a glove on your hand for if you're going to do it that way.
And look, I'd say always wear gloves and always wear a mask when you're gardening. I think they're really
very
important.
Very sensible.
Very important. I've got my gloves, I've got my masks, just sitting by the back door with my garden boots and thick socks, which are also important this time of year as well, because you never know what's in your garden.
And many people will be using bags of potting mix, and it's most important that when you open up the bag, you've got your mask on then, because dust will come out of it to start with. And if you're going to be using your potting mix, make sure you've got gloves on when you're using, you know, potting mix that's out of a bag or any times.
Definitely. Very, very, very important. We must have a chat about that in more detail one day, John. Thank you for the call, Valerie. We are going to be talking to Dr. Katja Hugendorn next about varroa mite, and we'll return to more of your gardening questions. The number 1300 222 891. Keep that one handy too for a couple of ABC gardening magazines I've got to give away.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Varroa mite has had a devastating effect on bee populations in the United States and Europe. Varroa mite is now in Australia, and it's been decided that it's here to stay. They can't eradicate it. What are the consequences? There's a lot of hype out there, and I thought it's an opportunity to talk to our wonderful bee lady, Katja Hugendorn, who's the native bee entomologist here in South Australia. Good morning to you, Katja, and thank you for making yourself available this morning. Could we start by looking at the varroa mite? We hear about the varroa mite and we hear doom, gloom. What does a varroa mite actually do to a honeybee?
Okay, so the varroa mite specializes on honeybees. It doesn't go to other bees, and it will breed on the larva. So it hitches a ride on the adults and spreads on the flowers, and maybe because worker bees go into another hive. But it will mainly breed on the larvae. And that causes some damage in itself. But what causes more damage is that the varroa mite is an incubator and a vector of viruses. Now, thanks to COVID, we know all about viruses, and they can be transmitted very easily. And it is the viruses that do the real damage to
them. Aha! So it's not the varroa mite eating or sucking the juice out of a bee. It's more the virus.
A little bit of both.
Sorry.
Yeah. A little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
The virus. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now that virus, there are many types of viruses as we now know. Do we have the virus that affects the honeybees here in Australia?
So there are many viruses that affect honeybees, and some are very damaging, and then beehives will die, but they will basically knock themselves out a bit. And what the virus that lingers on, the deformed wing virus, it is called, you can guess what it does to bees, and that virus didn't come with the varroa mite, as far as we know, and we don't have it yet.
Okay, so are we free from the effect of varroa mite, or is it just a matter of time?
No. We're not free of the effects of varroa mite, and they may cause damage, and they may cause damage in combination with other viruses. But look, it's not the end of the world. That's the thing. There's a lot of fear and angst around, and basically we will see some difficulties. Beekeepers will need learn how to manage for the mite. A lot of hobby beekeepers might think, I don't want to do that with miticides in my hive and checking all the time, so I'll look for another hobby. And there's an upside to it as well, John, because we are riddled, especially in Adelaide, with feral honeybee hives. So the honeybee is an introduced species here, and it went wild. You can find them in hollows in eucalypts, and the densities are enormous. And they are causing real competition with our native bees.
Aha, now, so on that, that's a very important point. So there's the native bees. They've been struggling because the honeybee gets first preference for the pollen and what's out there. So you're saying that if the honeybee gets knocked back a little, it may be to the advantage of the native bee.
Yeah, not only the native bees, because nearly all flying insects need nectar, because flying is high-octane business, as we know. And so nearly all flying insects go to flowers for nectar. And insects are very important, of course, for pollination and other things, but they are also very important food for birds and reptiles. And now most of the vertebrates, the reptiles and the mammals, they don't really like to eat honeybees because of their sting. And so there's only a few insect-eating birds that actually go for honeybees, but they go for the other insects, for the smaller, softer insects often.
Gotcha. How long before the varroa mite actually reaches South Australia?
I couldn't say. So far, the varroa mite, its spread in Australia has been caused by the beekeeping industry, and the spread via the feral hives will go slowly. But there will be a beekeeper who transports its hive, and then is what happened in the almonds. And so that is basically unavoidable, and for most of the time, this beekeeper doesn't even know that he's spreading it. So it's not on purpose. It's accidental.
Let's assume that the varroa mite does get to South Australia. From a gardening point of view, we rely on bees. We would probably like to have native bees, but we've been relying on honeybees to pollinate our cucumbers and pumpkins. And there are lots of fruit trees that need pollination by bees or insects. Could you go forward 10 years and just give us an idea of what could be? Will we still have enough things to pollinate our fruit and veg?
Absolutely. So we always see and think about bees as our main pollinators, but in actual fact, all those flying insects that visit flowers take some pollen with them and can pollinate. So it's been shown that about half of the crop pollination done in the world is done by other insects. And we've got a lot of flies visiting our flowers, and they will transport as well. So I don't think we will notice it. And also, the bees won't disappear from the face of the earth. I mean, the United States has had this for about 40 years, and they are still the largest almond-growing country, exporting country in the world. So there is a lot of fear and angst, as I said, but we will be all right. We will learn how to live with it.
There's a lot for us to learn about, particularly about pollination. And it so happens that in November will be Pollination Week. And I have extended an invitation to Catcher to come into the studio, and we'll talk pollination about bees and insects and things like that. So that's still okay, and that's still on, Catcher?
Yeah, that's still on, and maybe we have news about the varroa mite then as well.
Great.
Well, look forward to that in November. But thank you very much for a very short notice coming onto this morning's program.
Nothing. John, that's fine. Good.
Thanks, Katia. Dr. Katia Hoogendoorn, bee and crop pollination researcher at the University of Adelaide. If you haven't won anything from our station in the past month and you would like to win an ABC Gardening Australia magazine, you know what to do. Either tap the app and get through to us that way, or you can call 1300 222 891. I've got two to give away.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Off to Sandy Creek now. Linda, you have got a gum tree. What's happening to it?
It's been chewed up by the gum leaf skeletonizer caterpillar. And I've seen trees around the area that are virtually been decimated by this caterpillar, and I'm just wondering if there's any way of controlling it. I do believe a wasp has been found that will control it, and they're using that in New Zealand, but I don't know what we can do here.
No, it's one that I've been trying to get the right Australian native entomologist to come onto the program, because a lot of our native plants, people are planting them in the gardens, and they look beautiful to start with, and they get plastered with all kind of little insects, scale insects in particular, and caterpillars are munching them up. And it's because a gum tree doesn't grow by itself, except in our gardens. And, of course, in the bush, it's got lots and lots of other lower bushes, and they're the habitat for all kind of predators and parasites to keep the little greeblies that you're concerned about. And, of course, you put your gum tree in your garden, you don't have the right kind of understory, and so you've got a problem. I don't know that I can give you the answer to that. I need to talk to arborists. There are chemicals coming onto the market which are coming becoming available to home gardeners, which you can put in as a drench, and then it gets into the leaves, and if the insect eats the leaves, it'll bowl them over. Now, whether they're available to home gardeners and whether that's good garden practice, I've yet to determine. So I can't give you an answer on what to do. If you can spray, then I would be suggesting that you use a chemical called Success Ultra. Success Ultra is very specific to caterpillars and soft-bodied little critters, and it's very, very low in its terms of toxicity from you or the environment, and it is very, very effective. The trouble is the tree might be bigger than what you can spray from the ground.
Well, it is. It's at least 20 years old, and it's very tall. And where you're mentioning arborists, I'm wondering, could the eggs be spread by equipment that's been used to prune other trees?
No. They have a cycle where the caterpillars, they might be overwintering. They're in cracks and crevices. Don't blame the arborist for that one.
Linda, looks like you need some specialist advice on that. Sorry. Jeanette in Tea Tree Gully and Stephen in Peterborough are our magazine winners this week. Congratulations. Anne is in McGill. Now, Anne, you would like to graft an olive tree?
Yes, John and Deb, good morning. When's the best time to do that?
Right now, I should suggest. Olives are not the easiest to graft, but it's possible. Do you have the sign material that you're going to put into the tree ready to go?
It's from an existing tree, and I've got another tree already growing to graft it too.
All right. Well, I would suggest that you water the tree that is going to take the graft probably 2 weeks before and 1 week before, so you've got good sap flow within the plant itself, although it should have plenty of saps flow at this time of the year. And then with the sign material that's going to, the little pieces that are going to go in, if you've got them, keep them moist and wrapped up in newspaper in the fridge, not the freezer fridge, but just the ordinary part of the fridge until you're ready to go, and then have a go. Do lots and lots of grafts, because you may not get a large percentage of them to take.
Thank you very much, Anne, for that. Appreciate your call. I don't think we're going to have time for any more calls, John, because there are a couple of issues I know you want to deal with. We've heard earlier from Claire in Prospect on the text line saying, is there a safe organic way of controlling the aphids on our roses? Have we got aphids? I don't have an aphid problem at the moment, which is amazing.
Most people don't have an aphid problem, and I have hardly seen an aphid on a rose over the last couple of weeks, when normally the tips are plastered. You may have aphids in your gardens, but stand by. Talking to Chris Butler, our cropping agronomist at Roseworthy, and he said farmers have got heaps and heaps of aphids in their, particularly legumes, lupins and things like that, not lupins, doesn't matter. Anyway, they're out there in large numbers. And Dominic Cavallaro, talking to him yesterday, and he said there's a wave of aphids coming through the Virginia area at the moment, and the tomato growers there are taking action. So all I'm suggesting is keep an eye on your roses. It's likely that we'll get they'll come in on a warm wind, and once they're there, they'll build up very, very rapidly. Whatever you do, don't spray them with an insecticide. side. It's late for the aphids, but the predators, the good guys, the ladybirds and all those kind of things, and parasitic wasps in particular, they're out there, they haven't been affected by the weather, and they will have a field day. So be observant, don't spray. Watch the predators, and if you have to do something, squirt the tips of your roses with water. Dislodge the aphids, and that will help the predators have a munch up anyway. And if you do have to spray, then spray the tips with an oil spray only, which is non-toxic from an insecticide point of view.
Very important advice, John, at this time of year. Tanya also says on the text line, will we expect earlier hatching of citrus gall wasps given the warmer weather we're experiencing here in Adelaide?
Well, would you believe that's one of the items I'll be putting in next week's Good Gardening newsletter, simply because it is warmer and the emergence is dependent on temperature and day length. And I checked yesterday on the dates, and it looks like there could be about a week earlier than last time I mentioned. So round about the 15th of October is the date of a wasp emergence in Loxton. Now, I need to talk with our friendly entomologist here in Adelaide as to when that will be in Adelaide. But stay tuned. But more important, make sure that you've got, if you're going to stick them with glue, make sure you've ordered your glue or you've got your glue ready to go. Or if you're going to use kale and clay, again, go to your garden centre and make sure that they have ordered it. Because last year, people went to their garden centre, didn't have any, and by the time they went back to the wholesaler over in Melbourne, they'd sold out.
So it's important that you do, in advance, let your garden centre know that you're going to be needing it soon. And the timing of that is something that you'll be addressing in the coming weeks in the lead up to the middle of October there.
Yes, it's very important. If you wanted to, you can still prune. If you've got only a few little galls out there, you can prune them off the tree. But whatever you do, don't drop the galls on the ground, because the little wasp will stay alive and come out regardless. So put them in the green waste bin or in, do something to just destroy them.
Exactly. Yeah. Great advice there. Christine at Prospect says, my roses are covered in aphids. And this person says, tons of aphids, very hungry ladybirds.
So, interesting.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So they're on their way here.
They're little pockets out there, so take on board. Anyway, listen, there's so many things to do out in the garden.
Before I let you go, what are you doing, John, this weekend?
I'm off to a garden centre. I have a little sort of wander around a garden centre after I do each program. And apart from that, I'm planting my little ground covers in the front garden, and I'm halfway there. I've got 15 planted last weekend and another 15 to go this weekend.
Great.
So until next week, good gardening.